I'm often accused of being a dreamer, but what people sometimes don't recognize is the dedication and perseverance it took to make my dreams reality.
Howard Baldwin started as a minor league ticket counter and steadily worked his way up, eventually becoming a founding owner in the World Hockey Association, or WHA. Known as the Rebel League, the WHA was responsible for forcing the NHL out of its medieval stupor. In time, the two leagues would come together. Howard would play a crucial role in overseeing that merger in ending hockey's seven-year war. But during those 7 years, the League of the Outlaws put out seven great seasons of hockey. Among the teams, none would match the sustained success of Howard's. Essentially born out of a bluff, his New England Whalers were crowned WHA champions in the league's inaugural season. The Avco World Trophy would be far from the last piece of championship hardware Howard hoisted above his head. But now we're getting ahead of ourselves, because the path to that historic night in 1973, the entire path Howard took, was anything but straightforward. Nothing would ever be given. Everything would have to be earned. And he knew it, too. It's a journey that's hard to believe, especially considering that just months prior to the puck dropping on that first season, the Whalers were nothing more than an idea. A dream. At the time, one of Boston's leading sports columnists wrote that the chances of the 20-something-year-old successfully establishing a WHA team in New England were, quote, slim and none. After all, founding a professional hockey franchise requires an arena, players, and money. Howard had none of the three. But he had ambition. He wasn't afraid to dream.
To be accused of being a dreamer really isn't such a bad thing, so long as you're willing to work hard, to persevere. This is the story of what it took to make my dreams come true.
Welcome to Slim and None. My name is Stephen Maggi, and today Howard Baldwin and I will be discussing the building of the New England Whalers. Former Whaler assistant coach and general manager Ron Ryan will be joining us a little later in the program to discuss draft day and the building of the team. But for now, let's bring in Howard Baldwin. Howard, today we're going to talk about the WHA draft, and this is the very first draft, and of course, a really important place because up till now, we're talking a lot about franchises and arenas and places teams are moving and so forth. But now we got to put people in the uniforms that people can care about in the stands. First of all, you did it in Newport Beach. Why was it Newport Beach? There was no hockey. I mean, I know there's a lot of it in California now. There wasn't much at all, and certainly not in Orange County in the early 70s.
Yeah, well, Newport Beach is where the founding league office was. That's where Gary Davidson, Don Reagan, that's where the league office was. I guess they felt that's where they're going to do the draft. If I knew what I know now, would have been more outspoken of saying it's not a great way to get a lot of national attention, particularly in the hot bellies of where hockey is played. But then having said that, being, again, young and not minding going out Southern California for 4 or 5 days and having a little fun, that's where we went for the draft. And it was interesting because at the outset, before the draft even started, our friend Bill Hunter, who we talked about before, got up before the draft started and made this long speech about how this was the most important day in the history of practically the world, and also informed us that Allen Eagleson was outside and was going to come in and speak, and he better say good things, or we're going to send him out of here in a hearse, he said. I'm not sure he didn't say it where Eagleson heard him. So that was our first real introduction to Allen Eagleson, because he did come and speak and offer some encouraging words, obviously trying to keep us alive, to ratchet up the price on so many players. But that's where we did the draft, and it was memorable.
Well, from a media standpoint, you know, nowadays, it's a huge thing. There's contests to have where they're going to hold it and so forth. At that time, was there much interest from the press? Were you hoping to get some interest from, the hockey press of the time?
There was interest from the press, almost like a Ripley's Believe It or Not. You know, you have when you have the circus come in the old days, right? The circus would come, and then down below, you'd have a place where you could see the tallest giant, and then you could see the shortest midget and all. So we were looked upon, what is this WHA? Is it a real freak show? Is it really for real? So the media had more of a curiosity interest. I don't even think very many members of the media came because of where it was and because of the fact that, again, we were only 3 months into our birth, if you want to call it that. I am sure it did not make a loud noise around the country. Now, it may have more in Canada and more in markets like, you know, Boston, for example. Certainly the wire services picked it up. Minnesota, New York. But, you know, today, for example, for all the years we were in the NHL, now today the NHL draft is a huge event, and they do an incredible job with it, and they move it around the country, and the arenas are filled with the young kids that are going to get drafted and their families, and it's one of my favorite events. I just love it. But then it was behind closed doors, and you'd think we were planning the secrets to overthrow a country.
When you think of the Whalers, they were one of the most disciplined teams in terms of, you guys had a philosophy, which some didn't as much. You had a good coach there and so forth. What was the pre-work like? You know, I mean, how much it was involved? I mean, nowadays there's all the scouting and so forth. Obviously, you didn't have a lot of time for that, but there must have been a meeting or several meetings, I would guess, where you talked about what you were trying to get out of this, where you wanted to be at the end of the draft, what you had to look at from players.
Keep in mind, you had Jack Kelly, who was consumed with the Boston University NCAA Finals that year, because he was still actively coaching BU. You had Ron Ryan, who I believe was still coaching at college. You know, everybody was just coming into the organization, Jack Ferrara. And I know those guys did a tremendous amount of work, or as much as they could, with the resources they had. And of all the drafts that were held, the 12 teams, even then I knew enough to know that we had the most intelligent draft. We didn't go nuts. We didn't go for, some teams went splash and dash, you know, drafting Russians. Then you couldn't get a Russian out of Russia. And, you know, drafting people like Bobby Orr, and who wouldn't like to have Bobby, but it's just not going to happen. One team even drafted the governor of his state. So what Jack and Ronnie and Jackie Ferrara did is they really put together a draft that was team-driven and realistic, and that could be signed for a reasonable number, and that many of them had New England roots. If you look at our list, so many of them were, like, you had two or three guys, Jake Danby, Bobby Brown, Rick Jordan, that were BU kids. And then you had Boston College. You had Tim Sheehy, Kevin Ahern, Paul Hurley. You had Guy Smith from New Hampshire, great player. So your college guys were all local. And then you had Bruce Landon, who you know, was a fixture in Springfield, who was really top-level AHL, and a couple of top-level, you know, AHL players. And then Jack and guys went, you know, then they went off-campus, quote-unquote, and signed some really good, young, up-and-coming players that were within the NHL. Larry Plough, who was in the Montreal system, but he played his high school hockey in Massachusetts, big star in Massachusetts. That was a great choice. Then he got Rick Lee, Jim Dorey, Brad Selwood, three guys from Toronto, young up-and-coming guys. And Toronto was a great franchise to pick off, because you had an owner in Harold Ballard who all he could do was make fun of us, me, and the whole thing. He had utter disdain. Well, he had such utter disdain, he lost the future of his franchise by being arrogant and rude. And so we got three really good young players. We got Britt Selby in a trade, and then Tommy Webster from Oakland. And then the icing on the cake, quote-unquote, was Teddy Green, who was sort of, not sort of, our name that really resonated in the local marketplace. I mean, everybody, and I shouldn't say everybody, young people may not know, but Teddy Green was the heart and soul of the Bruins for years. And then he had a horrible accident in a stick fight with Wayne Mackey and on the ice in Vancouver, and he lost a year playing. And he came back, wasn't sure he could come back, and Jack signed him. He was our team captain, and he was, you just couldn't ask for a better guy and a better leader. He was extraordinary.
It was realistic, because I think so many people want those big, huge names. Not only did you do that and build a good, solid team for a first-year, first-league team, but also by having all those local players, that had to help attendance, because you had people that had some knowledge in the region of some of these people, so they were kind of comfortable with them. They were considered home guys.
You couldn't be more right, and that's exactly why Jack and Ronnie, and Jack, that's why they did the draft that way. A, it had terrific local brand identification. B, it was affordable. Every player had a point to prove, and every player was either young coming up or was like a Teddy Green. He had a real point to prove. He was going to say, I'm not done, and I'll show you I'm not done by just doing what I'm about to do in my own local marketplace. And when you have that many guys coming together with a point to prove the way our guys did, all of them had a point to prove that, damn it, we're good and we belong. And they all had a lot of guts because of that, because who's kidding who? You know, when you deal with a guy like Ballard, and if for some reason the league folded when it came to Rick Lee and Jimmy Dorey and Selwood and some of those guys going back to Toronto, some of them were very mean and vindictive, and they had no chance of going back there. I don't know what would have happened.
Well, you know, you talk about NHL arrogance, and I think part of the reason Jack was so successful, too, was going after these U.S. college players. At the time, they were really looked down upon, right? And yet, Kelly was smart enough to not get caught up in that, went after some of these people, and there was a natural affinity between that and some of the new fans of the new league.
You couldn't be more right. I mean, look at Jack. Here Jack is, the primo number one college coach at the time. And college coaches weren't taken into the NHL. The only one, I believe, was Ned Harkness, and that worked out so-so. So Jack had a lot to lose, and he had the guts to come over and sign on. And he knew the college market. He knew those kids could play. The other guy I should mention is Terry Slater. Terry came out of the college hockey market. He coached in L.A. Sharks. So the WHA did things for the American hockey player, the American executive in the hockey end of it, that wouldn't ordinarily have happened. It opened up a lot of people's eyes. And then very quickly, Europe entered into it, of course. Not the first year so much, mind you, but very quickly it did. Because, you know, you went from in 66, you had 6 teams. A year later, you have 12. A year later, you have 14. The WHA comes about, and you have another 12. So within a 5 or 6 year period, you go from 6 to 26 teams. Just do the math. People had to reach out for additional executives, additional players. They had to pull their heads out of the various parts of their body and realize, we got to get progressive here and give other markets and other people a chance. It's called competition.
You know, one thing you mentioned in the book, which I love, that you say some of these players were like third and fourth liners in the NHL. And I'm thinking, what a great way to build up. You're obviously not going to have an NHL team in the first year, no matter what you do. It's an impossibility. But that way there, because I know even today, if you take third and fourth liners in there, you could be pretty competitive. You really can, especially if you have that in a league like that. That's good hockey. That's not like watching minor league hockey.
Hey, you're right. I mean, when you know, to the untrained eye, you know, you go look at a AHL game or a great college game or two last place teams, and I don't know. It's good fun. It's a great sport because it's such a team sport. You know, when you have the changing of lines, so you have different players at different. It's truly a team sport, so that it can be entertaining. Look, the first year we had. Obviously, we had the best team, but there were years that we didn't. But it was never not entertaining. And that's one of the beauties of the sport.
You know, you had mentioned Ted Green, and he was like the one big name, if you want to call it that, at the time. But was that sort of important in terms of marketing the team and so forth? You wanted somebody, and him being a longtime Bruin kind of really fits into that. You need to have somebody in the same way that I think of like when Marc-Andre Fleury joined the expansion Knights.
Well,
it was
right.
Important. It worked out better than they thought, but it's important, right, to have that one name that people can identify with right off the bat.
You wanted a veteran or two that were tough and good leaders, because you know that first year there were going to be a lot of things happening, strange things. Things as a young player starting out that would worry you. And to have the stability of a fellow like Ted Green. And by the way, another fellow I forgot to mention is Al Smith, our goaltender. And he was right in the prime of his career in Detroit there when he came with us. Going back to Teddy, he was a grown up and mature. He had been through so much. He'd seen through so much. And so as things would happen in the league, and you read about stuff happening in the press speculating the league is going to fold and all that crap. And it's just a good calming voice to lead the players in the proper way. And that's what he did. And he was a godsend to us.
You paid $60,000 a year to him. Now that might not sound like anything now, but at the time that was big money.
It was big money at the time. Can you imagine that? The budget for players the first year, we went in at $600,000. And Jack, by around May, said, I can't do it at $600,000. He was annoyed with me. We got to have $700,000. And I wouldn't kid you, I was intimidated by Jack. So I said, okay, we're at a crossroads. I got to be able to stand up and resolve this. And I remember meeting on a Saturday morning at Statler Hilton, where our office was in Boston. And we made the great compromise to bring the budget in at $650,000. For the whole team. The average minimum salary in the league now, I think it's $750,000 for one player.
Well, you know, you mentioned you were a little intimidated by him. Was that the fact that years of hockey experience, and at that time, you know, it was a tight-knit group that, like you were mentioning before, there wasn't a lot of these people around, I mean, that really had that kind of experience.
He had great experience. He had never been in the pro game, but so what? The college game is close enough. But he just was so confident and so sure. And that's one of the things that I'm proudest of. We had the good sense to not be afraid to bring in people that we may have been a little bit in awe of. Jack Kelly, Bill Barnes on the marketing. I mean, Bill was older than we were, and he just provided that stable, calming influence in the office for when things got hairy, and that's what made us succeed. It was such a team effort from top to bottom.
A little modesty helps. I mean, you mentioned about Harold Ballard, right, from Toronto. Another place was the other team in town. As great a team as they had in the late 60s and so forth in Boston, they lost a lot of people. I remember that. Jerry Cheevers, you got Ted Green.
Well,
Derek Sanderson, I mean, my gosh.
Again, they were arrogant, and they just figured nobody's going to leave the Bruins. And, you know, when you throw the kind of absurd money that the guy in Philly threw around for Sanderson and Johnny McKenzie, who ended up playing for us, and to this day is one of my favorite people in life. But, you know, there's Johnny McKenzie. I think he was like 33 or 32. And to get a chance to be coaching and play for, I don't know what they were going to pay him, $150,000, whatever they paid him. Why wouldn't he do it? Same with Cheevers in Cleveland. And certain guys like that got picked off. You know, the Bruins in Toronto got hurt. The Rangers, they Emil Francis regrouped quickly and said, wait a minute, I'm not letting Raquel and Gilbert and I'm not letting them go. And so he signed them up, and everybody said, oh, how can you pay that much money to these guys? I'll tell you how, because he was smart. He realized this league is going to work, this WHA. Same with Eddie Snyder in Philadelphia.
And but, it's funny, they're all scared of the WHA, and it just reminds me a little of what the NFL was before Roselle got in there and so forth. There's this fear that somehow they're going to lose something, when in reality, what you guys brought in with your flexibility around the country and bringing in some of these players and so forth actually made their teams much more valuable in the long run, but they couldn't see that at that time, could they?
No. And again, they were a pretty arrogant group and pretty smart. Not all of them, mind you, but a lot of them were. And they just couldn't comprehend the kind of competition we were giving them. And some of them responded well and some of them didn't. But each WHA team did something in their market to establish credibility. Do you know what I mean? Like whether it be Ottawa with Wayne Carlton or Chicago with Pat Stapleton. Each team, if you look down the roster that first year, each had a couple of nuggets that said, okay, you've got good brand identification here in Quebec with J.C. Tremblay, you know, and there were others, believe me. But the thing that Jack did was he didn't go from one extreme to the other. He went, you know, right down the middle from player one to player. Then I think there were 17 or 18 guys on a team, knowing that he had a solid team from top to bottom.
And when you look at it, it makes so much sense because there were some teams, like you said, it seemed like everybody had their big star and so forth. But as great as those people are, and they do draw people, at the end of the day, as you think long term, winning is really what's going to keep fans coming, right? You know, or at least a good chance of winning.
Yeah, most of the teams had a significant drop-off from the top three or four guys to the next layer. We didn't have a significant drop-off at all. Jack had both 17 or 18 guys all could play and compete with anybody. Now, some went on, obviously, and had long and great careers, and some, you know, sort of stayed at the same level. But, you know, we got Lee and Dory and Selwood and Webster and Al. We got them when they were 24, 25, 26. So they had great careers in front of them.
And the other part of hockey, unlike some other sports, you know, you have line changes and so forth. Well, it's great when you have that great first line, but when your third line is terrible, it comes back to haunt you.
Yeah, that's right. That's the great thing about hockey. It's a team sport. There's ever a team sport, it's hockey. And Jack drafted that way.
Well, let's take the opportunity to bring in Rob Ryan, the assistant coach and assistant general manager of the first edition of the New England Whalers. Ryan, along with coach Jack Kelly, built the team, and Rob was with Howard at the draft table in Newport Beach on the phone with Jack back in Boston. We all know that the first person chosen in the draft is a big deal. Well, we're going to talk to somebody that, if there was a draft around at that time, he might have been number one, Ron Ryan. Ron, you know, coming out of Colby, you were a hot property. Do you ever stop and think, boy, if I was playing now, what a difference it would be? There'd be people all over the place trying to get you signed up to be the number one pick.
No, I try not to think about that because when you see the money being paid these days, I think about the guys who came along in my era who did play and who were underpaid for so long. It was pretty sad when you look back on it.
When you got involved with Hartford, and I want to kind of get a feel for it, they come to you with this idea from a whole new league and so forth. And how did you get in there? And were you kind of hesitant in the beginning because it was an unknown entity at that time?
Of course, it all relates back to Howard and Jack Kelly. I had played hockey for Jack Kelly at Colby, and he was my coach for 4 years. And then I actually went to followed him to BU after my senior year. He went to BU as their coach, and I followed him there. But I ended up at Pennsylvania going to graduate school and coaching their hockey club. So I didn't really stay at BU. Howard had hired Jack as his GM and coach, and Jack approached me to be his assistant coach and general manager.
And Howard, Jack must have come and told you that he wanted Ron as his assistant. You liked the idea of those guys that they already knew each other because you were all about like having a good philosophy going in.
Well, for me, it was exciting because even though Ronnie and I didn't know each other, being a fan of the sport, I knew what a great player he was and his hockey record, and he's too modest. I remember the first day of training camp at BU, we all think we're like me. I played at prep school and all, but we all skated that first day with the team, and Ronnie was probably better than 80% of the players that were coming to training camp. That's how good he was. He was just a fabulous player, and he, to me, and Ronnie was always that sort of calming presence, working with Jack to pick the team those guys picked. They were, to me, were a great combination. It was very exciting for me to be able to have Ronnie Ryan in our lives then and now.
It must have been an exciting thing, too, working with Jack, because you already knew, you know, you'd played for him and so forth. So you must have felt comfortable coming into this kind of strange new world that you're coming in with a guy that you kind of shared the philosophies and you knew how he coached.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And, of course, it was a Jack and I both at the time. He was a superstar college coach for many years. I was just completing my seventh year as a college coach at Colgate, which I loved, and we were doing very well. Unfortunately, we had a change in admission directors, and the last two, my sixth and seventh year there, I literally was not able to get any of my top 10 players that I had recruited accepted. So I was disgruntled. As much as I loved Colgate, I was very worried about the future of the hockey team because it was just really hard to get my players in. So I was interested, and when Jack called me, we did have a four-year relationship then as player and coach behind us, and then 7 years we were competing against each other in college. But I had a lot of comfort in him, and when I met Howard, I became quickly as enthusiastic as they were. I love the name of your podcast, Slim and None, I think it is. And, you know, that's what everybody was telling me about the possibility of success for this new league. Now, I looked into it. First of all, I had a lot of confidence in Jack, and I immediately had confidence in Howard once I met him and got to know him very quickly. As you know, he's not a hard guy to get to know. But looking at the situation, I mean, there was no doubt in my mind that Boston at that time, and still, arguably, was the number one hockey market in the United States. But at the same time, there was a tremendous amount of competition there. It's a four pro sports city, and we made it five. And actually, they had the Braves there from 71 from 74. So just in the hockey situation, we were going into a situation, a brand new league, to compete with the Boston Bruins and the Braves, who the Bruins wisely had moved there to. You couldn't get into a Bruins game, and they were drawing double figures, 8,000, 9,000, and 10,000 a game in 71-72, the year before we started. So add to that the college hockey, the popular draw they were, and it was a real great hockey market, but there was a lot of competition. So we thought about that, and that, I think, became front of mind for Jack and I when we were thinking about the team, because if you look at the way we built the team, one of the areas that we looked for would be local draw. And the team we ended up putting together, that was a big factor. Obviously, the playing ability was a major factor, but the fact that they could be popular in Boston and help the team draw and become successful, that was a critical area of our thinking. The interesting thing about putting a team together in that situation is you had nothing to measure it against. I mean, we had a philosophy that the top college players could be very successful in professional hockey and contribute to a successful team. And as a result, I haven't done the the research now, but I'm quite confident that we ended up with far more college hockey players on our team than any of the other WHA clubs. And, of course, at that time, there were relatively few college hockey players playing in the NHL.
You wanted to play in the real world. You wanted people you could actually sign. And like what Ron's saying here, the marketability, there's no question. Was the fact that, you know, you and Jack have been around that New England area, that the familiarity with these people was important too, because you knew what they could do and you'd seen them and you kind of knew what their personality was like a little bit before you even started?
Here's the interesting thing about the startup year. In reality, you know, in the hockey world at that particular time, you drafted players, you had them on your farm teams and things like that, so you had to negotiate a contract with them. Our job was more like we had been doing in college. You had to recruit these players, and you had to try to convince them, just like we did in college. I had to try to convince a player like Tommy Earl, who ended up with the Whalers, to come to Colgate instead of going to BU. We really layered in the fact that they would be popular in New England and in Boston, and that they would be assets to the team player-wise, but that we thought we had a chance to get to move into our situation. It was a recruiting job, really.
Take us to the draft day then. Howard, you're in Newport, right? And I think both of you were down in Newport when that happened. Kind of take us through that day.
Ronnie's the key, but I mean, I was there with Kobe and Godfrey Wood, and Ronnie was obviously there and conducting the draft, and Jack was back in Boston on the telephone.
But you know, how many days did this thing last? You know, nowadays they go on for days. Was that more than a day?
I know. I was shocked to. I read up a little, and I know it because they talked about in the 70th round the governor of Minnesota being drafted by the Minnesota team. 70 rounds is a lot of rounds.
I don't know how we ever arrived at that, because I did a little research on that too, and there was the preliminary draft in which each team could pick four players.
Yeah, I do remember that.
We picked Bobby Sheehan, a Boston boy, who was playing in Oakland. Yeah. Eddie Johnson, because we knew we had to have a good goaltender, and he was a Bruin. And Larry Plow, who was another Boston boy, and Ricky Lee. They were our four priority selections. And we ended up signing Larry Plow and Ricky Lee. And Bobby Sheehan, he was a very exciting player. He was playing in Oakland at the time. They were not a very solid franchise. And we loved his crowd appeal, being a Boston boy and being the type of player that he was. And Larry Plow and Ricky Lee were both NHL, had NHL experience. And they were both in situations that we felt we could work with in recruiting them or signing them to come play for the Whalers. Larry Plow was on a Montreal team as a center. The other three centers were Henri Richard, Jacques Lemaire, and Peter Mihalovich. Scotty Bowman was the coach, of course, and he was having quite a hard time getting ice time because at that time, contrary to today's hockey, it was pretty much a three-line system. The fourth line was penalty killers, and you didn't get much ice time. So we felt that gave us a real head start on convincing Larry that maybe he should take this step. And Ricky Lee was on a Toronto team that had eight solid defensemen, four really young, 24 and under, who were all regulars or NHL, definitely NHL quality, but they were in and out of the lineup just because of they had so many defensemen. And we felt that that was an opening for us, and we focused on Ricky Lee because we loved his competitiveness and his come to play every night. But as it turned out, we ended up signing three of them off that same team to start our defense with Teddy Green and these three NHL players who had considerable experience for young guys, two full years in the league. And I think, without a doubt, we ended up with the strongest defense. We added Paul Hurley to that, who had 2 years of experience in minor pro and was a Boston boy. And I think that one of the strengths of our team, or a major strength of our team, was this defensive crew, which was really anchored by Teddy as a leader and by these three young Toronto Maple Leafs who had 2 and 3 years experience in the NHL.
Was there scouting in those times? I mean, you know, because I think now, and there's like all with the computers, obviously you have more scouting reports than you'd ever want. Back then, when you were going through like 70 rounds and so forth, did you have a lot of that, or how did you even decide that?
Well, you know, I come from the background of late with the Philadelphia Flyers, where I, in general, we had 14 full-time scouts. We had Jack Kelly, myself, and Jack Ferreira. The scouting was us, and it wasn't easy. I mean, now scouts, you go to scout a game, you get full credentials, and you're welcomed in, and so on and so forth. At that time, we had to sneak into buildings. In sellout situations like Philadelphia and Toronto, there were no tickets available. I made contacts at players' entrances or press entrances where I would slip the guy a couple, and he would let me in. I remember
great.
In Philadelphia, where I ended up spending a large part of my career, I had a guy back at the Zamboni entrance that I would grease a little, and he would let me in the rink because it was always sold out.
Howard, what was your part as you're listening to them, and there's all these people from all over and so forth? Were you like looking at like, well, how much is this going to cost?
Yeah, that came later. I mean, really, I quickly realized we couldn't have been in better hands than with Jack and Ron and Jack Ferrara. And, you know, the hockey end of it wasn't my bailiwick. Mine was sales, marketing, and whatever you have to do to try to drive revenues. But in my humble opinion, Jack and Ron and Jack Ferrara were brilliant the way I said this to you the other day. Brilliant the way they put this team together.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Rob. We hope to have you join us again later in the series. Howard, let's get your analysis of the building of the team. So you guys get done with this. You had to feel pretty good. It was all people you could sign. It were people that could make an impact right away. Did you know that we have a pretty good lineup going into this? Did you feel that way? Or did you think, God, I wish there was a couple people I would have loved to have gotten, but somebody beat us to it, or we couldn't sign them, whatever it was?
No, I mean, I'm not going to pretend that I had the knowledge that Jack or Ronnie had. I mean, we had great confidence in them, and we knew enough to know that these were good players. You know, certainly we knew the college kids were good. They were all American. Knew very little about the minor league guys like a Landon or a Caffrey. Caffrey ended up being Rookie of the Year. But the NHL guys, we all knew they had been in the NHL, which was exciting to us. So, no, I couldn't tell you. I came away from there thinking, oh, boy, we're going to win it all. I just couldn't. But we had confidence in Jack because he had great confidence in himself. And the way he conducted himself, did Ron and Ferrara. The media really in Boston was very fair to us, I felt. You know, they were willing to give us a chance. They were kind of rooting for us because the Bruins had an arrogance to them in those days. I don't think anybody had anything against the Celtics or the Patriots, but, you know, we're hockey, so hockey's compared to hockey. So they kind of had an arrogance to them. We never got as much, you know, airspace as we hoped to get. But we were in a market that had four or five other major league teams. I remember that those were just in the days where you had car phones. But they were car phones like a satellite walkie-talkie. And we would drive in, commute, three of us, Bill Barnes, Johnny Coburn, and I, from Marion, Mass. To Boston. And there was a show on WBZ called The Guy Manila Show. It was the number one talk show. And they never talk about us. So what we would do is call him, wait on this party line, hope we got through, and then pretend we were a fan. And it usually was Bill Barnes that would do it. And he'd finally get on the air and say, how about those Whalers? Aren't they exciting? That's the way we got on the air.
Well, sometimes those are things you have to do, but I have to feel that probably was better than expected, because there's a certain feel, and especially the old-time writers and so forth, when something new comes along, the initial thing of, well, it's not going to work. You know, I've been covering the NHL for umpteen years, and that's the pros, and that's that. So to have them at least give you a shot really had to be a good thing there, because you have, let's face it, you were competing with the Bruins no matter what.
Yeah, we were competing with the Bruins, but we also, and a lot of people forget this, we were also competing against the Boston Braves.
Yeah.
If you remember, the Bruins NHL just won the Cup. You had, you know, to this day, some of the greatest players in the history of the game, with Orris, Vito, and Hodge, and Stanton. You had some great players, Cheevers. And then you had the American League team, which they decided to put there, the team, their American League team there, a year or two before we came into the picture, the Boston Braves. And they were drawing 10 or 11,000
wow.
people a game. You know, most people thought we were nuts to go into Boston. There you are with a great NHL team
yeah.
and a really successful AHL team and the Boston Celtics.
Yeah.
And I tell everybody, well, we just went into the belly of the beast is what we did.
But, you know, the AHL team drawing that kind of crowd, did that signal to you that, hey, if we put a decent product out there, there's definitely a fan base for another team?
Definitely. And the one team we did hurt was the AHL team, because they, shortly thereafter, we left after the second year. They left, I don't know if it was after the first year or the second year, but they left.
Fascinating conversation. We're going to continue this trip into dropping that first puck. So on the next episode, we're going to talk about the arena situation, which is not done at this point.
And I think the fun thing will be to get into some of the league meetings and some of the things that went on there as we progressed closer and closer to opening day.
You know, one last question. They say all successful people are risk takers. Certainly, when you were sitting around that room, that was a room full of risk takers, wasn't it? I mean, that's not for the faint-hearted.
It's not for the faint-hearted at all. And you know, it's interesting when you analyze what does risk-taking mean. Okay? Well, guys like us, we were very fortunate, and we were young. So for us, if it didn't work, we'd rebound and do something else. For Bob Schmertz, I wouldn't kid you, and if he were alive today, he'd laugh and say, you're right, Howard. If it didn't work, it was a write-off. For some, they put everything into it. So that's real risk. And for some, they felt this is easy. Some people feel that getting into sports, because they read about it every day, therefore they think they have all the answers. And they have no idea how hard it is. And how hard it is to assemble a product, to sell the product, to sustain what it takes to do all of that, and not only count on your own team to perform and do well, but count on your fellow partners to do well. It's a grind. It is a constant, constant grind. But there it is. If you don't want to get into it, don't. You get in there by your own choice.
This is a roller coaster ride, and we'll continue the next dip next week. Thanks for being with us, Howard. Appreciate it.
Love doing it. Thank you. See you next time.
Well, thank you for joining us today on Slim and None. Next week, we will examine the league as a whole, which are the strong franchises, the weak ones, and how close was the league to being able to drop that first puck. Thank you for joining us again. For Howard Baldwin, this is Stephen Manchin.